Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, which airs weekly on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Jenna Howard, whose new book, Doing Time Outside, comes out this month from Standing Stone Books. I spoke to Jenna Howard in 2010 about her novel Night Navigation. Jenna Howard is a graduate of the University of Vermont and received a master's from Teachers College, Columbia University. She then taught English to grades 10 through 12 for 27 years. Jenna Howard's stories have appeared in Waterstone Review, Permafrost, Portland Review, Descant 145, 1111 Journal, and elsewhere. Several have been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She has been granted residencies at the McDowell Colony, Blue Mountain Center, U-Cross, Saltonstall, and Hedgebrook. The National Alliance on Mental Illness of New York gave Jenna Howard their 2009 Media Award for work on behalf of those with mental illness and their families. Her novels Night Navigation and Doing Time Outside are part of a trilogy of books, each of which is written to stand alone. Book one of this trilogy, Rope and Bone, will come out in the summer of 2014. When I spoke to Jenna Howard in 2010, I asked her if she's always been someone who wrote.
I didn't start writing until my late 40s, and it was strictly by chance. And I think maybe the biggest thing that happened was that for the first time in my life, I had some time. I'd always worked full-time. I had a family. I taught high school English. And so my children left home, and I had some, you know, white space. And then in the midst of that, New York State started encouraging teachers to write with your class. I had never considered writing at all. The only writing I'd done, research papers, literary essays as an English major. I went to the University of Vermont.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no such thing as creative writing. I don't ever remember that even coming up. But, of course, as an English teacher, I was teaching books, so I knew that. But I never considered doing it myself. So what happened was New York State started encouraging teachers to write, saying, how can you teach something that you don't do? And so they also started having poets come into the school, stay for 3 or 4 days, do a workshop with the class. And the poets were very clear that they expected you to sit down and write with the class and that you would indeed be sharing your work with the class. And I found that scary, that I was going to have to write something and that I was going to be reading it to my students and they would be under the same gun, you know, I would be under the same gun they were. So I started, and the poet happened to be very encouraging. It just let me know that when you're ready and you meet your teacher, it's that kind of situation. And I think he just wrote something across the top of the paper that really encouraged me, which was, he said something like, you make it new. It was a love poem about walking along above the sea at Montauk and about my fears of that, and it was all metaphor. So that's kind of how it started. And prose came to me later, a little bit later. And so that came from being in a bar one evening, and a woman started telling me her life story, and it was very different from mine. And I went home and tried to write it, and I actually got going on all that and wrote about 100 pages, and it was awful. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know how to make a scene. I didn't, even though I'd read all my life and I loved language, and I'd done a lot of reading out loud in school with students because I had so many students who read poorly. I just didn't know that. So I took a wonderful workshop with a woman named Charlotte Zoe Walker, who actually lives near me and is a retired English professor now. And then I had gone to a workshop at Skidmore, and someone had gotten up, Lynn Barrett, and said, this is how you write a short story. By that time I had the 100 pages, and then this is how you write a short story. And I must have been ready, because I heard what she said, and it was the usual thing, start in the middle, don't start with the weather,
right.
You know, show, don't tell, and it was the show, don't tell that was my problem. I was telling, you know, a lot of it, and I took this workshop at the college, a semester course at night, a lot of students and community people there, and the woman, Charlotte Zoe Walker, was so good, because she she agreed to read the first 100 pages plus the one short story I'd
Oh,
written.
wow,
And she
wonderful.
was a great reader. And what she said about the first 100 pages was, none of this, but this. Because by the time I'd gotten to the short story, I really was beginning to get it. And so that's basically, you know, how I started. I really got kind of serious. I mean, I must have been just right because I began to really try to learn how to write at that
Yeah.
point.
Yeah. Now, were the 100 pages and the short story all the same material that went into Night Navigation?
No, I wrote a novel and stories before I wrote Night Navigation. And the novel and stories was about two families, the Merricks and the other family that you meet in Night Navigation, the Merlettis. And so it was a novel and stories, and there were many different points of view, but it was all these same characters from the years 1963 to 1993. So it covered that span for these two women. But it was also in the different points of view. I'm really interested in points of view.
Yeah.
Of the sons, the husbands, the lovers, the women. It does, most of them are in the women's point of view. Some are in first person, some are in third person, that kind of thing. And I worked on that off and on for more years than I can even bear to think,
yeah.
And got better and better and better and learned. And that actually is book one, called Rope and Bone, and
okay.
I'm hoping, that's how I got an agent, and I'm hoping that book will still sell. It hasn't yet. I think novels and stories are a little harder, although certainly Olive Kitteridge has done very well.
Yeah, right.
That's basically how I started. I just sort of fell into it.
And I read that Night Navigation will be a trilogy, so that would be the first book of the trilogy, that other
right.
one?
Right, and then Night Navigation is book two, and now I'm working on book three, which picks up a couple of days after Night Navigation closes. It's the other family. It's
wow.
the Merlettis, and I'm hoping that Del and Mark, the two main characters in Night Navigation, don't come knocking at the door. I've really had enough of them. So, you know, who knows? And so far, so good. I'm halfway done. I hope to finish by the end of the summer. And they are mentioned because I think anybody who read Night Navigation would like to know how they're doing, those two characters.
Right.
So they're off in the periphery, and you'll know how they're doing, and you wouldn't have had to read. They all stand alone, so you wouldn't have had to read Night Navigation. But really, it opens up with Carla, the mother, with the other mother in Night Navigation, and Tess, the daughter, pulling up to the jail,
okay.
the county jail. They're going to visit him. He's been incarcerated. And
right.
so that's the way that novel opens.
And that's Rudy, Tess's brother.
That's Rudy Tess's brother, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying writing it. It's a completely different process from Night Navigation, so that's very interesting.
And now I have all these new questions popping into my head, but I almost feel like before we go any further, I might ask you if this would be a good time for you to read the opening to Night Navigation, and then we'll talk some more from here, and that way people who haven't read it have a sense of it.
The book is divided into four seasons, and this is March. So this is chapter one, home. The house is cold. He doesn't look at her, just sits hunched at the kitchen table with the hood of his sweatshirt up, undercover, her son. He is even thinner than when she left. The stink of cigarettes, something rotting in the dark of a cupboard, and the sink is right to the top with dirty dishes, hardened strings of spaghetti, grease congealed in a pan. A still life. She could paint it on a wall of canvas. Moldy glasses, big as barrels, their funhouse faces wavering beyond. Welcome home. The wood box is empty. She knows without even going in there what the bottom of the tub looks like. One whole end of the pole barn will be stacked high with trash, a month's worth of garbage, leaking random pools on the floor. And all of it is pretty much how she thought it would be, given what he was up to when she left. I'm too sick to do anything, he says. His hands pull at the sides of his hood. I can see that. Close the shutters. Goodbye. Luke took off running with Benson's dog just before you came up the road. When Luke didn't come rushing to greet her, she'd hoped it was only this. How she's missed that dog. Some woman from your painter's group called. It's on the machine. He finally looks her way. if you can drive me up to Carla's to get enough to where I can function for the next few days. I'll be able to make the calls to line up a bed at a detox. I'll get some wood in, clean up around here, make me almost normal. Through the window, she watches the plastic tarp smack the uprights, most of the last few cords exposed. A lot of the logs will be wet. All right, she says. If you agree not to contaminate this space, you told him 2 years ago, you may stay until you become more stable. This, after she said he could not come home when he called desperate from Oregon, after she had refused to send him bus fare, after she had changed her phone number to unlisted. A week later, she'd found him crashed in his drum room down in the barn, the heat turned to 80, a cigarette burn as big as a nickel between his fingers where he had passed out without even feeling it there. The path round the house to the wood is a slick of ice. It's so March, she almost laughs. Everything gray, dank. Sleet finds its way down the back of her neck as she shifts the wood around, looking for a few small, semi-dry splits to start a fire. Hard to believe that only 48 hours ago she was kayaking on the Gulf toward a small island. Ahead of her, an egret, still, waiting, a shock of white in all that green. That's what she'd like to put on canvas, the shock of white on green, or the light and dark of flesh. The life drawing group will be getting together again in Marna's studio now that the hard cold is past. She hears barking, scans the hillside toward Benson's for a dash of brown. Need to deal with Benson's dogs on the loose. It's the only time Luke leaves their land. Soon, Benson's hill will disappear. Once the leaves are on, no one would know anyone lives over here. Only another 6 weeks or so. The buds are already making their move. The stove is so full of ashes, they spill out as she opens the door. Above her, in the loft, she can hear Mark on the phone putting together some arrangement that will yield him some of Carla's morphine, what he needs to bring him to almost normal. She taps the stovepipe to hear how much buildup. Chunks of creosote crunch around the edges of the clean-out door when she starts to ease that open. Probably a lot of low, smoky fires all of February. The stove was always Aaron's job, something he took on when he was in sixth grade, the winter they moved into the stone house, the year after their father, after Lee's death. There's no newspaper. She needs something to get the fire going. She hates to risk the refrigerator. Any boot of calm she's got left, or denial, may drop away. She reaches in, without really looking, and grabs what she knows will be a mostly empty, sour carton of milk. She rinses out the stink, shakes it good, and crushes it under her heel. That, with a couple of ripped cereal boxes, has a 50-50 chance if she gets just the right amount of air going between the splits. She hears Mark say he'll get the whole 200 he owes to Smithy when the money comes. Smithy, Carla's boyfriend. Smithy's got to be at least 50, the same age as Carla, 10 years or so younger than she is. Drug accounting is complicated. Food stamps, benzoid meds, transport to buy, homegrown, miscellaneous, what equals what is open to interpretation. Anyway, Mark may be gone by the time his disability check gets deposited, tucked away in detox. Do not grasp the detox plan. It may happen, it may not. No kitchen matches. The book matches jar is empty as well. These will all have been used to cook up in a flare, and now dozens of them will be out in the March muck, tossed from the loft window, still aflame, she supposes. Though it's always painful to come upon these burnt offerings, she appreciates their honesty. This is what I'm doing this week. She's never actually seen Mark, any of them, in the act. Her first hypodermic encounters, something banging in the dryer, something dropping from a pocket and a stack of clothes getting bagged to go to the Salvation Army during one of Mark's cross-country bus times, produced a case of the shakes, left her breathless. Now, when she stumbles on something, a blackened spoon behind a paint can in the barn. It may make her cry, but it's no longer like someone kicked her in the chest. She reaches back into the cupboard and behind the flower, kitchen matches, cashed for just such occasions. But he's been straight with her, mostly. Her being his rep payee for his disability money is critical. Gas to drive him to mental health when he's going to mental health, when he's taking his meds, his license suspended 2 years ago for not paying a speeding ticket, food, heat, phone, DirecTV, NBA pass, socks, whatever it costs for him to be here comes right off the top. And he never tries to con any of that. What's left is his, usually about $200, and it's all gone in a couple of days. Running out of cigarettes caused hassles for the first couple of months, him, needy, and wanting an advance for just one more pack, the 9-mile trips to the Quickway in Stanton, the looming possibility that if he didn't get a Camel, she'd end up having to drive him to crisis the very night freezing rain would up the anxiety of the venture by times 10. She started buying 6 cans of tobacco, rolling papers, right out of his grocery fund. When his cigarette money is blown, he has the wherewithal to make his own, which he hates doing. Please, may she never hear another whine for nicotine in any of her future lives. She tilts the top log at a good angle and opens the front vents all the way. She loves his big old stove, but it's a bitch to start. Definitely. If I end up getting a bed somewhere, then I'll wire the money. There are long pauses. She knows Carla is giving him full scenes of the latest. He said this, then I said that. Her arms doing flamenco accompaniment. Her eyes, her eyes. Back when she and Carla were marijuana smokers together, back when she was Carla's friend, there in Carla's kitchen, fascinated by it all. The motorcycles parked in the yard, the stories of Harley Rendezvous, the family album of pagan arrests, way back, 12, 13 years ago, 5 years before Aaron's death, back before Carla's surgery, before Carla got into pain medication, before Carla's son Rudy, before Mark became junkies. This fire's not going to work. She rummages around in the bottom of the kindling box for shreds of bark and pushes them under the top log to rest on the milk carton. Yeah, I called Rudy up and threatened to tell. He owed me 50 for the food stamps. I wanted my money. Mark doesn't lower his voice. She's on the truth side of the operation. Drug dramas and manic depression, hard to know which roller coaster you're riding. In the 2 years Mark's been back from Portland, off and on crashing with her, she's never consciously tracked the sequence of events, but each month unfolds almost exactly like the last. Everybody's got money, so there's a frenzy. Cars in and out, down at the barn, the lights burning late, the rumble of Mark's drums, the throb of guitars. The money's gone, and everybody's starting to get sick, despair, and isolation. Somebody hawks something, another flurry, treading dark water until the beginning of the next month when everybody's got money. All of it punctuated by variations of fallout, car wrecks, and arrests. Not Mark. He never goes to that edge, thank the gods, or he's just lucky. And yes, the occasional plunge towards sanity, the Navy, a halfway house in Arizona. She's a reluctant witness. She turns off the ringers, turns down the answering machine, closes as many doors between her and it as she can. How many years has Mark been her main concern? And every time she comes to that question, she always has to add it up again. Since she and Lee separated the first time when Aaron was 2 and Mark was 4. Since Mark was 14, right after Lee's death, in utero, at least 20 years, that any call in the night registers 10 on her adrenaline Richter. When things heat up beyond her tolerance, she plans flight, a one-room apartment with no return address. She wakes in the night, a rock of anxiety jammed under her sternum, and she starts mind-listing her options. He goes, she goes, and all the permutations of that. Or, in what she thinks of as tar baby time, say, when he's got another knot of infection swelling his arm that's redlining its way toward his heart, and she's driving him to emergency again, she wishes he'd just go ahead and kill himself and put them all out of their misery. But she knows he's getting somewhere. A lot of the time she's sure this is the best place for him to be. His father's, his brother's ashes buried up on their hill, they're all here together, working on it. For sure, if I go, it'll be at the Great American before noon. Yeah, she's going to bring me up in about 15 minutes. She is preferable to Mom when you're 37. His long legs appear, make their way down the loft ladder. Approaching Wellsville, he says. What? It's all set. I could take your car. I'll drive you. Up the dirt road to Carla's. But she cannot. She will not. Out on winter highways, drive him anywhere else. She touches the match to the waxy edges of the Raisin Bran wrap and closes the stove. Within seconds, there's that reassuring roar.
Well, thank you very much for reading that. I'm wondering how you decided where in their timeline to begin the book. Did you ever change the starting point?
What happened for me is that I hadn't written for a couple of years. I had tried. I think most anybody who reads this book has a pretty good feeling that Dell and the writer, Jenna Howard, have been on traveled through some similar worlds. It's just that kind of novel.
Right, well,
know?
Or else the research would have been incredible.
Right, I mean, it is fiction to me. There is a tremendous amount of research. Once I decided, you know, to do the second point of view, to do Mark's point of view, mm-hmm. for me to get inside the head of a 37-year-old man with addiction, I've never been to rehab, I had to research all that, read books, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, as a writer yourself, that once you start working, it just becomes fiction. But that was a critical piece. What happened was I was really blocked. I didn't write for a couple of years because I sort of thought I was going to do this material as a memoir. Mm. And so I just never could find the voice. I couldn't do that. I had written mostly fiction before, and most often when it was anybody close to me in third person, close. I use that point of view often. I can do Carla in first person because she definitely is not me. But anyway, that's what happened. And so I so wanted to write. I went to a fiction workshop with a woman named Murmur Blakesley, who's a very good writer herself, has a couple of published novels, was one of those Barnes & Noble's great discovery writers kind of thing. And she runs the workshop. And it said, please come with a couple of pages of something. And I had no plan. I don't usually have much of a plan, actually. And so I just sat down and thought, well, I could try this, or I could try this, or I could try this. And what happened was, I said, well, I'll try this. The house is cold. He doesn't look at her. And it simply came, and I'm not usually a quick writer, but it just came out. The first six pages simply burst out of me. And I've really not changed that much. It's very close to what I originally wrote. And the big stroke for me was when I got to the end of that. I thought I was just trying to write a short story. I was very audacious, and I thought, my God, this is a novel. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I thought. But the next big thing was I thought, and it's got to be in alternate points of view. I've got to now, if I'm going to make it into a novel, because I had such a similar experience to Dell's, and you know how hard that is to make something become fiction and not just keep writing all this stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And the chapter, I realized that's got to be in Mark's point of view. I'll have to do that. And I'm going to alternate the chapters. And I am very interested in point of view anyway, point of view and tense. I knew it was going to be in the first, I knew it was going to be in present tense. And then, so once I started Mark, I just took off. And I always found Mark easier to do than Dell, because I just knew too much about her. So I'd keep bogging it all down with backstory.
Right.
That really bogged down the forward momentum of the story. And I always enjoyed doing him more, because what I love about writing, probably more than anything else, is the rhythm of the words.
Yeah.
I love that. And he has such hot, he's got such hot language.
Yeah.
So I found that very wonderful to work with.
Now, I did want to ask you about the structure of the book, and I wanted to ask you on a couple of different levels. First of all, the four seasons, the structure around the four seasons, and then, as you say, the narration passes back and forth between Del and Mark. So but I guess both of those things interest me. I'm curious how you came to the structure.
The four seasons was that I thought originally I was going to do a couple of years in these people's lives, because it really, I felt like it was that kind of a situation. It doesn't happen quickly. And as you said, the book does get somewhere at the end. Not everybody feels that, but I truly feel, not that and so they lived happily ever after by any means, but there's like a little light that comes in. You know, it's a pretty dark story.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, I thought, I'll do a couple of years. And what happened was, I got to page 150, and it was still in March. So I had to solve that issue. First of all, I had to say, well, it's not going to take a couple of years, but I did have to have it last at least a year, because we wouldn't get anywhere. And so in order to do that, then I thought, okay, I can have the opening section be March, and then I can skip a few months and call the next section July, and skip a few more months and call the next section October, and then February, because that's the when it goes through all four seasons. And that solved the problem of this not being a 2,000-page manuscript.
It seems to me that the way you ended up doing it, and perhaps it was because of page count, but ultimately, this is, I think it's hard to be in this story constantly through every minute of their lives. It's a very tough life that they're living, and I think it probably did the book a certain kindness to kind of break it up and just show us what's happening at four different points in the year rather than every moment of the year. So
absolutely. And for me too. Yeah, no, that was important, just as it was important to really cut this book down. It went from, you know, 515 pages down to 325 pages. And the editor, a great editor, Ann Patty, who was at Harcourt and at the time that the book was bought, and then Houghton Mifflin bought Harcourt. So there was, in the midst of that, there was that scramble. But she was, I didn't always agree with her about what she wanted cut. And when I didn't agree with her, I didn't cut. But she was right overall, and she was very right about many of the things that she wanted me to cut, partly because it is a dark, you know, it's such a dark story.
Yeah. Now, this is just a little curiosity of mine. I actually have gone back and forth myself trying to decide whether or not to name chapters in a novel, and you did in this novel, so I'm curious how you decided to do that, to name the chapters.
I always name chapters. It's like a high point for me for some reason. And they're always important, even though maybe the reader doesn't necessarily think so. And I love that, because one of my favorite books ever is Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood, and she names chapters, and she names them, and even the layout of the book is very interesting, what she does with that. So I'm sure some of it's about that, but chapter headings are, I don't have them ahead of time. I don't have them usually until later, but I feel they're important. In the novel I'm working on now, they're really important, because there are more characters than that, and each one of them has their own thing. Like, one of them is very Catholic and religious, and one of them is very into becoming a vet tech, and then we've got the man in jail, and then we have the mother who goes off on astrology. So each chapter picks up one of those people's obsessions, sort of. And so that's important. Anyway, yeah, I always name chapters.
Okay. When I was reading Night Navigation, I was struck by the fact that there aren't more novels about postmenopausal women. Is that just me? I mean, I was reading...
Oh, I hadn't even ever thought of Del that way.
Well, I guess because there's this beautiful scene where she and Richard make love, there's a moment where she's reflecting on how sex has changed for her a little bit, and I don't know, part of that scene seems to be her stage in life and her age, and
yes,
and,
definitely, that's true. I just hadn't applied that title to it, but you're absolutely right about that, and that's important, and I think that's important to their relationship, because they are older. They're in there. You know, she's 60 in this, 62 actually in this book.
Right.
So it
just struck me when I was, and I don't know, maybe because there are lots of books about these women, and it's not necessarily always got a sexual component to it. I don't know, but that that moment struck me.
Some of that's the whole Welcome to America.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, older women are, they're a little more in
right.
than they were at one time, but
yeah.
but it is an issue, and that's important. Yeah.
How did you come to choose the present tense for the book?
I just feel like the story is so immediate, and it is moving through time,
mm-hmm.
And you need to feel that immediacy for the story itself, and because it is moving through time, going back and forth, and I think it's a pretty quick pace of happening, and so I'm very attracted to present tense, and of course, that at one time not too long ago bothered some editors. Using a lot of fragments bothers some of my readers.
Mm.
They think it's choppy. I think there are people that haven't read a lot of current contemporary literature, because I think what I do with rhythm is not very unusual at all if you read recent stuff. But if you haven't, I noticed when a lot of people on Book Browse did reviews of the book. They send out books ahead, and so people do pre-publication reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of the people would say at first that they were bothered by that. And then they would later say, but that was okay later, because they really felt like it reflected Mark's manic state and that sort of thing. And they came to be okay with it. But it can be tricky. And present tense, too, I think, bothers some people.
It's interesting, though, because I feel like this is a very character-driven novel. And I think that the way that you chose present tense and chose to write, and maybe slightly fragments, it really does reflect his point of view or Dell's point of view at any given moment, and really puts us right there in their moment.
Right, so. And I don't really decide that in a way. It's sort of that's the way it comes. The voice comes to me,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not that I just say I'm taking down and I'm not in control. I don't really quite go there, but it kind of, as some writers say, they're just being dictated to. But because I'm a very slow writer and I work on every sentence, every the and in this book has been chosen, just like a lot of writers.
Yeah.
And so that's just, but that is the way the voice came to me.
Yeah. Well, we're talking a little bit about character here. And on your website, you include an interview in which you're quoted as saying, by working in the third person, by imagining the interior of this man, and you're talking about Mark, I was able to enter places, to walk around in rooms where I could never have gone as myself. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about your process for developing character, and maybe specifically Mark's character.
I think that was really, as I said, it was critical to work in Mark's point of view. That was the only way the book was really going to leap into fiction for me. And this is not my story. I didn't want to tell my story. When people say to me, oh, it must have been cathartic, that never rings any bells with me. This isn't therapy. The only part of writing that's therapy for me is the going off by myself for 3 or 4 hours in a disciplined way every day. That's very empowering for me, just as a discipline. It could be any number of things I'm doing. So, working on Mark was big, and as I said, it came very pretty, except for having to do research, and sometimes I'd have to stop because I just had never been to a therapeutic community, and I had to find a way to get there by doing research and that kind of thing. But third person clothes for Mark, there is a lot of interior. That's why I have the dog. I don't know if you noticed. I often have a dog in my books, and Mark, really talks to the dog, and I think the dog is very important. He's an important character because it shows a lot about Mark, how much he cares about the dog, and it's a bond between the mother and the son, the dog.
Right.
But that's what comes up sometimes if you're doing a lot of interior because you do have the character alone, and Mark is alone quite a bit. That's sort of the nature of the deal.
Yeah. So that would have been hard, I would think, like particularly when he's in, I'm trying to think, did he have any real solitary moments in detox? But those...
Well, he does, because he's in the, he's in the room at first.
The three-hour chair.
Right. Oh, that's when he's in the therapeutic community.
Oh, that's in Lazarus.
Yeah, and he's actually psychotic at that point. He's having a psychotic episode. But he's sitting there and all that stuff is happening. It's weird. He thinks he's being looked at and so forth. A lot of the times when you get Mark in these places, he's often verging on a break, verging on a manic. you know, episode.
Right.
And I think sometimes writers, readers miss that because they're always saying, you know, the big thing in this book is the people who want to call this a tough love, let go issue.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always saying, you know, why don't you just let go and be tough and stuff like that. And I think they forget that almost all of the help that she's giving is often when Mark is, one, making a move toward recovery. He's
right.
making the calls. He's going there. Or he's actually sick. He's in a psychotic state,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I always want to say to those people, do you have children? Well, you know, when they say, why don't you just let them go, you know, put him out the door or something. I just want to say, do you have children?
Right.
So often what she's about is that he is moving in sort of the right direction in a very twisty way.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little bit about the process of publishing this book. How did you find that process?
It's been, I would say, 99% positive, but I want to say I had no idea that that's what's involved. I thought you wrote something, eventually you got an agent, the agent sold the book, it got sent back to you for a few revisions, you did some, the copy editor sent it to her, and about 4 months down the line, they published it. But it has been an amazing process. It's very much expected writers now, unless you're a very well-known writer, that you'll do a lot of the marketing. You'll have to help with the marketing. And
mm-hmm.
so that isn't anything I ever thought about doing. And I actually have become really gotten into that. From the beginning, doing your website, I collaborated with a wonderful website person, Marianne Mackay, and we really collaborated. So that was very exciting. It was the kind of thing when it went online, it was the birth, you know, the birth of my website. And I love my website. So the publishing process was just much more involved. I've done 36 readings. Those were all arranged by me. And I've, you know, and I told you originally I had to cut out the 150 pages. The original manuscript was 515, it ended up with 325, whatever the math is on that. Because I didn't realize it, but a manuscript page is just about the same as a book page. I assumed that the books would be shorter, but they aren't. And so I just assumed that was going to happen. So it was very hard for me to do all that cutting. And sometimes I absolutely did not agree with the editor. And so if I didn't cut there, I had to cut someplace else because she was very clear, this book has got to get down to such and such.
Right.
And I think she was right about that. But sometimes she would suggest things that were I was not going to do. So I'd have to find something else. And I've told this story before, but one of the things I did at the very end, because words, she would tell me, how many words? Can you get it down to 92,000? You know, it started at 142,000 or something.
Right.
And so at the very end, I went through and made contractions of every single word in the book I could just to get... do that to a chapter, then I do a word count. 100 words, you know, less. Great. And I was crazy. But so the publication process has been, you know, it's been very positive. And I have a really wonderful agent.
How long did it take you to get an agent?
It took me a long time to get an agent, but I think mostly it was because it wasn't ready yet.
Mm.
It wasn't about, oh, the publishing world's so cold and that kind of thing. I, after all, started out as a total beginner. I didn't know a thing about writing.
Yeah.
I think I had the temperament for it, which is I like to go off alone and sort of play.
Yeah.
And I loved words. So those two things were going on. And, of course, I'd been an English teacher, so that's a good backup for in terms of having read aloud a lot and so on and so forth. But no, it took me a long time. I didn't get an agent till I think 2004, and then the first book didn't sell, even
yeah.
though I think she put a lot into it. So publishing has been and continues to be. It's always a little scary because, of course, you wonder how it's going and are you selling any books and that kind of thing. I mean, I didn't care about any of that when I wrote, and basically that's not why I write. I always write because it's good for me to go off by myself and do something like that every day or
yeah.
5 days a week or something like that.
When you got your agent, did you have an introduction to her or did you
yes,
cold call?
I would have to say that almost every good thing that's happened for me turns out to really come from some kind of a connection. And I don't mean a connection in the sense that if the stuff wasn't good, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. But Murmur Blakeslee had the same agency I did, which is the Jean V. Nagar literary agency, and her agent was Jean B. Nagar. And so Murmur said, you know, when you're ready, I'll recommend you to her. And when I sent a query in with a couple of chapters and saying, Murmur's spoken to you about me, but that's really helpful.
Yeah.
And then what happened was Alice Tasman, who's another agent in that agency, didn't have a full list, and so she was willing to take me on, and that's just been a great partnership.
So she, how long did she work with the first book before she
she's a good reader, too. She's not only a good agent, but she's also a good reader. I think she has an MFA herself, and so she made some very helpful suggestions, chapters that still were not working, and so I revised some more, and then she sent it around. She really tried to sell it, but it just didn't sell, and I think that's, again, partly because it still probably wasn't quite ready. I've worked on it again.
Yeah.
And also because I do think that's a harder form to sell.
Jenna, what writers have influenced you, either personally or just through reading their works?
I started writing at the time that, and I'm sure the writers that were called this wouldn't appreciate it, but at the time that minimalism was in,
uh-huh.
when Raymond Carver was sort of hot stuff with his stories,
yep.
And I think that very much influenced me because the workshops I went to at that time and what I was reading sort of set up the thing where, in general, I think I do very little telling. I really count on the reader to get the clues,
mm-hmm.
and I like that. And so I don't like to read work that, you know, that does a lot of telling. A first person narrator that's just very lazy and tells you everything. And so that I was certainly influenced by Raymond Carver. And then I took a wonderful workshop. This is when I first started writing at Skidmore Writers Institute, which has runs a 1 month workshop and has for many summers for a long time since the late 80s, I think, with Russell Banks.
Mm.
And he's not only, I think, such a good writer, but also a great teacher. And he really liked Carla and Dell. And so on the basis of that, I was just a beginning writer. He said, I'll give you a recommendation of my age. Go home, write a book of link stories about these women. I love these women. At the end of the year, let me know. I'll give you a recommendation to my agent and my editor.
Wow.
Now, that was a wonderful thing for a beginning writer. And so so certainly that whole thing was paying off, I think, about showing and not telling. And then I like a lot of writers, loved Middlemarch, Dickens, Faulkner, Moby Dick, that whole world.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the stories that Russell Banks recommended was T.C. Boyle's Greasy Lake. I don't know if you've ever read that.
It's
a rite of passage story, Jersey boys who find a dead body, a place where they go to just sort of drink and hang out. And it's just very hot language and very rhythmic, and I think that really influenced me because I do think rhythm is very, I think I am a very rhythmic writer, and it's very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I work out loud when I'm working. That is not, you know, every few paragraphs I read back what I've got so far kind of thing.
Right.
To just hear it. So that was important. And I love Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. I don't know if you know that novel.
Yeah,
that's
beautiful.
One of my favorite novels ever, partly because it was the most wonderful thing to teach that book to high school senior boys, sit around in a circle with them doing it as a play. You can do that with kids. They can drop off the tags. They can read. You can get your best readers to be the main characters.
Oh, that's
and for God, yeah, young guys to sit around in a circle and be in the jungle, and of course they get to say all those words that you normally can't say in school. So I love that novel, and it's very hot too. The language in that's very hot. It retells the same story over and over again from different points of view. I mean, it's just a sort of a collection of vignettes more than a novel. And it's one of those books. It's hard to say just what it is. I really liked This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff. They're wonderful. I love Mary Carr's works. I love to read Alice Munro if I'm not writing, because it's so discouraging. I just think, oh, give it up. Don't even bother. She's so good. But she and I don't write anything alike. I don't know how she writes. She breaks all the rules.
Yeah.
The last paragraph she brings you forward 20 years in the character's life and, you know, in 50 words. She's amazing. I mean, she can go in to the real dark core of what it is to be a human.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She is amazing. Well, I have one more question for you, Jenna. And actually, I found a part of night navigation that I thought set this up well. At one point in the book, Mark's old girlfriend, Sammy, visits him in the detox facility, and he asks how she is, and she says this. She says, "The story I've been working on, I can't find the end, a place to get out, so I'm not writing at all." And at other points in the book, Dell is struggling with next steps on some of her paintings that she's working on, and it all feels very familiar. So I was just curious, as a writer, what advice do you have for other writers who occasionally get stuck and have trouble moving forward with a piece of work?
Well, because I usually am working on a novel, I think that might be somewhat different, say, if you're a poet, because I think poetry maybe comes from a different place.
Uh-huh.
I have written poetry, but this would maybe apply perhaps more to a person who's working on prose. An old student of mine sent me a link to an on-site writing thing, and the advice from the writer was, butt, butt to the chair. And I really believe that about says it. And even if you are blocked, I know that, I think it's Nadine Gordimer who says, no matter what, she went into her office or writing room or whatever it was called, she sat down, it may have been Joan Didion, but it's probably many writers that said this, she sat down and she counted that as writing time. She might not have gotten a single word down, but she sat there for 3 or 4 hours, I've forgotten the length of time. And of course, since I don't make a lot of plans, everything's pretty much made on the screen. I just sit, and if I'll sit, it'll come.
Yeah.
But if I don't sit, it doesn't. So that's my main advice to anybody who's blocked or whatever, is that you just need to keep sitting down. Not that I always follow this advice. no matter what. And on a regular basis, at a regular time, the main thing I'd say is just keep sitting down. I don't need to necessarily make a lot of outlines or plans. But the other thing is, sometimes when you aren't writing, it's because you aren't ready to write yet. It isn't about just sitting down. It's that your mind is sort of trying. The book I'm working on now is 99% imagined. And so every time I write, it's like stepping off into blank space and hoping that a limb is going to snag me on my way off the cliff. Because I really don't know sometimes where I'm going. And so I have to sometimes take a break, because I have to at least have some idea when I start where I'm going.
Yeah.
Because I don't do any free writing or anything like that. I mean, what I get from my first sentences of that chapter is probably what I'm going to have. That's where the story's going.
Yeah.
So I must know something when I start. And that, you know, that's where I go. It isn't necessarily where I thought it was going when I sat down, but that's where I start. So anyway, that would be my only advice, and I think that is the main thing.
Just stay in the chair.
Stay in the chair, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
I really enjoyed it. It was fun.
That, again, was a conversation with Jenna Howard. You can learn more about her work at her website, jennahoward.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic gigabit network. And VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. Given that we're moving into August and that the nights are growing cooler, at least in Vermont, today's Write the Book prompt is to write about the end of summer. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you'd like to share this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, news about book-related events, a writing prompt, or the outcome of one of my writing prompts that you'd like to share, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this has been the podcast version of Write the Book, which airs every Monday at 2 on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.